everybody. Welcome to the Antifada. This is Sean here. It is March. The weather's turning, thank God. Finally, here in New York, I am with the inimitable John Garvey, back. Old friend of ours back on the show for what will be the first in, I think, a long series. John, how you doing?
Okay, Sean. Thank you.
Good to see you. Thank you for inviting me into your home, which happens to be in my neighborhood. We kind of live in the same neighborhood, which makes this really, really convenient. So as I mentioned, I was thinking of a way to like produce some good content, some like relaxed content, maybe a little content now that I'm back to work that doesn't take as much effort, maybe as like writing a 10 or 20 page paper. And I can't think of any better person to talk to where we could have a nice, fun, casual, good conversation about the news, about political economy, about current events than you, John. So for those of you at home in TV land, this will be a mini series. I think a lot of it's going to happen behind the paywall. So if you're not a member yet, tune in and subscribe at patreon.com/theantifada. And I think like once a month or so, John and I will sit down over nice cups of coffee. Thank you for that. And shoot the shit. Maybe we'll talk about the neighborhood. We'll talk about life of the new left as you lived it, your critiques of what others did in the past, and maybe critiques of what you yourself, you know, have done in the past. So that listeners out there who are maybe just getting into things or trying to think critically about their own moment and their own left can take some valuable lessons forward. So,
okay.
All right, everybody. So without further ado, let's talk about the news. So here's a news article from today. I find it really, really interesting. It's from March 1st, 2025, updated on March 2nd. It's from the New York Times. It's entitled, "In NYC's Ukrainian enclaves, Trump's rebuke stirs complex feelings." So John and I talked a little bit about this. For those of you at home who haven't been paying attention to the news, J.D. Vance and Donald Trump dressed down Vladimir Zelensky in the Oval Office just the other day. He had come to discuss and potentially sign a rare minerals agreement with the United States, where the U.S. would get first crack at exploitation of those minerals. And in return, Zelensky wanted security guarantees. Trump, not so eager to sign security guarantees because, just like NATO membership, he doesn't seem to want to keep the United States embroiled in all that stuff. So that's what's going on. The New York Times sometimes has good articles like this where they actually, you know, what is it, beat the shoe leather. And they go down to the couple of neighborhoods here in New York City, Brighton Beach being one of them and the East Village being the other, where Ukrainians live. We've apparently got 150,000 Ukrainians. These are the rank and file, you know, of a larger sort of geopolitical battle going on right now, which will really, I think, as we're seeing, affect how power works, capitalist power works in the 21st century. I think it's fascinating to imagine that here in our little metropolis, New York City, we actually have people on the ground with real stakes in this stuff. And we should take that seriously. And we should talk about this article. John, you even read this article in the paper before you and I spoke. What did you think about it?
You know, I mean, I'm hardly an expert about your Ukrainians in New York. Although I would guess that the Ukrainian population out in Brighton Beach is somewhat different than Ukrainian population in the Lower East Side, East Village, in the sense that many of the Ukrainians out in Brighton Beach came from, they used to call it a kind of
Little Odessa.
Little Odessa,
right?
There are so many people there, but that they came to this country relatively recently. They came for, let's say, sometime in the last 30 or 40 years or more recently. So, whereas for the most part, I think the Ukrainian population on the Lower East Side is deeply rooted. It's been there for a long time. There, as you mentioned, there are restaurants, there are cultural centers. There's an important Ukrainian church.
Right, right.
On the street.
Yeah.
And it's a center of traditional Ukrainian life. And if I read the article correctly, it seemed as if that there was not a clear cut, but somewhat significant split between the kind of the common sensibilities of the folks out in Brighton Beach and those in the Lower East Side.
That's the sense that I got too, which I found really, really interesting. when we talk about traditional, these are people who were immigrants in the early 20th century. So these,
my God, or they're now their children and grandchildren,
right? If they stayed on the Lower East Side, which many didn't.
You know, I think the only thing that, I mean, some parts of that Ukrainian neighborhood remind me sometimes of some of the old traditional Italian neighborhoods that are still scattered around the city. That
Arthur Avenue, Bensonhurst, yeah.
But like you said, for example, that you've been working in Gowanus a little bit. Yeah. There's a kind of an enclave around just around the Gowanus Canal, around Carroll Street and President Street. And you know, one of the ways you can tell is that there are these like social clubs that have same storefronts probably for 30 or 40, 50.
Yeah.
And I think that there's a kind of, there's, whereas I think for the most part, the Irish, you know, families that I was surrounded by when I was growing up tended not to have that deep sense of connectedness to the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And they were kind of, like my uncle was on the first, you know, kind of car ride out to Long Island, you know, kind of to be part of what became White Flight. My parents stayed, but it was not part of a kind of a larger ethnic of some sort, religious ethnic kind of affiliation,
right,
connection. But anyway, I think that the Ukrainians have some of that, and I wouldn't be surprised that there, think about it this way, that there are people whose families have probably owned, you know, tenement buildings or light buildings on East 3rd Street, East 4th Street, East 5th Street, but 40, 50, 60 years.
Maybe 100 years in some cases, yeah.
And now it's, you know, kind of now these properties are worth millions of dollars. But in the meantime, it kind of, they've provided a place for generations of the family to stay and to live. And I think that, and even, I guess another aspect of it is that even if people no longer live in that neighborhood, it's the neighborhood they go back to.
Yes. Yeah.
For celebrations, for family get-togethers, for important religious observations and things of that sort.
Which is why, you know, like a place like the Ukrainian National Home, which is a restaurant, can still survive. And I don't think it's because, you know, as you said, there's a ton of Ukrainian people necessarily, recent immigrants even living in that area, but simply because as it's like a hub, you know, that generations of Ukrainians head back to. I've got a little anecdote from that. You and I were talking about when I first arrived here, when we first met, and I also lived in the neighborhood then, but I worked for a moving company. And I had a moving job on the Alphabet City. I'd say it was probably like 11th Street and between Avenues A and B, or maybe First and A. And it was a very interesting job because we were moving some younger people out of this building. The landlord for the building lived on like the second floor in a nice big apartment. But midway through the move, we had to stop because an older gentleman, I think his last name was probably something like Fomenko or something ending in K-O. He was an old Ukrainian man. Was heading down the stairs to go out for the day. This man was ancient. He was probably 95 years old or whatever. And the landlady sees that this guy's walking down the stairs and holding up all this traffic and starts bawling him out, yelling at the guy like, oh, you're always causing a disturbance. I wish you would just move and get the hell out of here. Ba, 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 ba. The landlord in this case was like a younger woman in like her 40s. You know, maybe like a professional woman, you know, maybe she worked for a university or the school system, or she worked at a hospital or something like that. She owned the building now, and it became clear that this old man was rent controlled, and he was an obstacle to like the full value of this building. And he was an old Ukrainian immigrant man, you know, with an accent and everything. And I got to talking with the guy, and he's like, oh, they want me out of here. You know, this woman, she bought the building 10 years ago, and all she does anymore is try to get us old timers out of the place. Bah, 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 bah. And that for me was really indicative of like what the neighborhood was, having been like an enclave for immigrants, whether Ukrainian or Puerto Rican. I mean, it's tough to call Puerto Rican people immigrants since they're Americans, but you know, it had been a Ukrainian neighborhood, a Puerto Rican neighborhood. It had been a Hell's Angels neighborhood. It had been a hippie neighborhood. And then eventually
Catholic worker neighborhood.
Catholic worker neighborhood. There you go. Vorwärts, like a forward Jewish workers neighborhood too, like a fiery history, and also a squatters neighborhood it became eventually. And an artist's and a punk's neighborhood. And now it's kind of like a real estate neighborhood. It's kind of like an NYU neighborhood. So this, it's no surprise then, would like temper the views of maybe the Ukrainians of the East Village versus the Ukrainians of Brighton Beach. It's not surprising that they're different. But what is it that they say in this article is one of the things is that Trump in this most recent presidential election did pretty well among Ukrainians. And so it seems like certainly with the Brighton Beach folks that there's, if not some buyer's remorse, at least like some conflict between what it is they voted for and what they're seeing now with the way that this administration is dealing with the Ukrainian government.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, it's hard for me to gauge, in leaving Ukraine narrowly behind us, for a side rather, for a moment, what exactly is, if anything, are the shifts that are occurring in mass sensibilities amongst the kind of broad mass of Trump voters. Mm-hmm. Let's leave aside Trump supporters. That's a different category, I think. I can only assume that some of them are having second and third thoughts.
Yeah, buyer's remorse.
Or kind of buckling down, you know, sort of they're strapping in and they're in for the long haul. Exactly where it falls out, I don't know. I should say that it seems to me hard to imagine that we're going to put up with this kind of spectacle for another almost 4 years, that this is only 1 month in. And it's exhausting.
It is.
Just to watch it, to listen to it. Sometimes I don't know which is worse, listening to Trump and his cast of characters or listening to various elements of the liberal commentary,
yeah.
Okay, who basically only have one song to sing. This is unprecedented. No one has ever done this before.
Even though he went through this 8 years ago, right?
And they kind of seem to simply have no notion is that it's, they're adding fuel to the fire. It's, what more could Trump want than people to keep on insisting that what he's doing is unprecedented?
Absolutely. Because that's his self-understanding now, right? I mean, I've been really good this time around, less so 8 years ago, but this time around I've been pretty good at trying to tune out the hysteria of things. And I think the hysteria, as we talked about last time you were on the show with Jana and Andy, has been muted this time around. You know, there still is, of course, you know, every time something terrible happens, the Doge people fire a whole bunch of like national parks employees, I think was the most recent thing that happened, and there were massive protests. I don't consider that like hysterical, but like the sort of equivalent of like the Russia stuff, the Trump is in hock to Putin and blah blah blah. I've tried to keep the hysteria at bay to try to understand like what's actually happening, what rational kernels this irrational politics is actually responding to. I think Ukraine is a really good example of this, right? Because there's been this drift, you know, in the Biden administration. There's been a series of failures of American policy, but also like a real victory of Russian policy in that region that it seems like the previous administration, at least in its composition then, and the previous media in its composition then, was unable to kind of understand or certainly to work their way through, which Trump and Trumpism and MAGA and its and him and J.D. Vance dressing down Vladimir Zelensky in the Oval Office is kind of a reflection of a if not necessary, like we would consider it, like this has to be done, but like some sort of historical necessity being expressed right now. As under Biden in Ukraine, it seems like we were drifting closer and closer to World War III. Every time there was an escalation, I would seriously think about the missiles. You know, I would think about the Cold War. I would think about the 80s, which I barely remember, but I do remember the Cold War and like, you know, nuclear drills and nuclear annihilation and nuclear holocaust. It seemed like, you know, just based on inertia, that's where we were headed in this conflict that's ultimately between the U.S. and Russia. And so seeing like the necessity that something happened, that something be different, not necessarily Trump and Trumpism, which is contingent, but instead like a recognition from the U.S. ruling class that the solutions that they were trying to impose upon Eastern Europe were not leading anywhere productive for anybody.
Yeah, I'm not sure about all that, Sean, but one thing that does puzzle me a bit, a lot, is why it is that, as for argument cause, the traditional U.S. ruling class, in other words, not the tech bros, not the people from Silicon Valley, although for all practical purposes,
they may have so much wealth and influence now that the other class, ruling class, doesn't matter quite as much. I'm not sure about that. But how quiet they have been, so many different matters. You know, they kind of, they issue statements. They, you know, kind of the five ex-secretaries of defense all say this is terrible. Five ex-directors of the Central Intelligence Agency all say this is terrible. 475 economists from prestigious universities. But it seems to me that they are, in many ways, missing in action. There is no, we, you know, what we need at a time like this is a ruling class that acts like a ruling class.
Yeah.
That steps in. And I mean, and that was true, I think, during the Biden, you know, era as well, that the, why did they let him drift for so long about so many things and to repeat the same tired, you know, kind of slogans or strengths to be voted in again because he passed the infrastructure bill or, you know, whatever. I mean, maybe it's part of it is they are seduced by some of their own, not exactly propaganda, but their own worldviews. They don't know the difference between what the stories they've been telling themselves and, you know, in reality. I mean, to give an example of that, I don't know if you've been aware of this. There's a recent Netflix series called Zero Day.
Oh, I haven't heard of it.
So Zero Day is a somewhat fantastic, I never count, it's I think five or six episodes. And Robert De Niro plays the ex-president of the United States.
Okay.
A Biden-like figure. Who is, you know, kind of on after a kind of a cyber attack that disables almost all of the nation's communications networks, but just for 1 minute, but for long enough that over 3,000 people die.
Oh, from like planes falling out of the sky.
Whatever.
Yeah.
And he's called back into service to head up a commission to find out what went wrong and to stop it. And I won't spoil the story.
Yeah, no spoilers.
If it's a curious melange of, you know, kind of evil tech people, of, you know, very, very kind of sinister political kind of characters. And then side by side with that, a kind of a core of people who are holding on for dear life and preserving the America that we always needed to be preserved.
So it's from the point of view of the people who are preserving our way of life as it needs to be preserved.
It's a very, very complicated, convoluted journey it goes on to get there. And Robert De Niro is pretty interesting as the president. I mean, he's...
And he's a good lib, too, I think, in real life.
I think that the people who kind of made that movie really do believe that that kind of, that script, that plot, that it is, in fact, the way things really are.
Yeah.
I don't think that they can tell at all that this is a story that they've been telling each other for a long time in various ways. Like one of the people responsible for it is a man named Michael Schmidt, who's a fairly prominent New York Times journalist. And his fingerprints are all over it. And it's kind of their way of making sense of the world. Now, I want to emphasize is that I find this period, and I think we talked about this a little bit the last time we saw each other, I mean, a very difficult period to make sense of. None of my usual kind of go-to explanations seem to be very adequate to trying to make sense of what, in fact, is going on, and let alone what to do about it. So it's not as if I'm telling them, I can't believe you're so stupid, and I'm so smart. No, that's not the story. But I think we should all be somewhat, not humbled exactly, but we should probably, consistent with what you said a few minutes ago, we should learn to, you know, kind of hold off and not to jump to conclusions and not to join in the hysteria. And for example, and I believe we did talk about this the last time, I mean, if I understand correctly, so far with all of the hoopla about the immigration raids, relatively few immigrants have actually been arrested and deported.
That's my understanding, too, much less than under Biden or certainly Obama, who was like the deporter in chief.
And the what's the source? I mean, part of it, of course, is that I don't know that Trump's various apparatuses have the capacity to know what they're doing. You know,
yeah, I think the actual task, as laid out by the real hardliners in his administration, which I think would be Stephen Miller and this Homan guy, the guy who's in charge of ICE, I think the logistics of it are daunting. And I think that, like most administrations, like most politics, like most business, the path of least resistance is usually the one that people go for, at least initially. And it also seems like mass deportations is something that the Trump administration is going to get they're going to get their hands dirty eventually with, but they've got several things that they want to sort out first. But I think the path of least resistance for them has been what the callous right-wing nationalists would call self-deportation, right? Scare the shit out of them. This goes back to, the traditional ruling class you're talking about. I think Trump's victory has scared the shit out of them. This goes back to the Europeans. You know, where are they? Kicking up a mess here with what's happening with Ukraine. You know, why are they just kind of letting Trump tear up all the old NATO nostrums, right? I think they're scared, and I don't think that they're scared of Trump per se, and I don't think that the traditional ruling class, certainly what they tried last time, which was to delegitimize him, which was easy to do because he didn't win the popular vote, I don't think that they're trying it because ultimately I think they're scared of the voters. I think they're scared of the citizens. I think they're scared broadly of the masses. And I think if anything, what the shift has been in the last election has been like a legitimizing shift for a new form of politics, a new type of political economy, a new type of American empire, an evolved one, maybe moving out of the rules-based international order and something more like great power politics of the 19th century, moving away from a progressive taxation regime and towards some sort of tariff regime, moving from kind of like de facto open borders, as we've seen over the last 10 years or so, towards a much more like nationalist regime when it comes to border control and in industry and things of that sort. I think that that traditional ruling class is cowed. I think right now they thought 8 years ago they could get away with a delegitimization campaign, say that this result didn't actually happen. Brexit, for example, didn't actually happen. But now I think the kind of accumulated chaos of the last 8 years, which is the responsibility of both Trump and Biden, but more broadly, I think a breakdown, like a broader social and economic breakdown in capitalist society, has them scared shitless. And I think that ultimately they are scared of us to the extent that like the masses, the broad masses, represent a legitimacy that they need in order to rule.
Following up on that, do they have any sense of, well, to what's that? Is it which parts of those masses are especially dangerous? I mean, it seems to me, for example, that become a commonplace that my far left commentators basically say we have never been weaker. We have never been less well prepared. And there's an awful lot of flailing about of trying to latch on to some clever phrase as being, this is what we should do. But I mean, I would make a suggestion that the ruling class may very well be worried, concerned, scared even, but it probably doesn't have an especially good idea of what exactly it is scared of.
Yeah.
That I think that, I can only hope, for example, that looking back on the last 10, 15 years, given the number of times when the masses of people in this country and elsewhere in the world rose up as if out of nothing, you know, almost by magic, okay, whether it was the George Floyd moment or earlier ones, that, or Occupy even, or even some of the kind of COVID-related protests at the end, that same thing is lurking, and that very well could be what they're really worried about. Now, whether in fact there is something that's worth worrying about, there is another question of whether we have the capacity to do anything different the next go-round to ensure that something coheres, that endures.
I don't think, I'm doubtful, actually. Like, I don't think what I'm saying about the the quiescence of the traditional ruling class, or at least the last ruling class that we had, and their maybe fright at the possibility for a mass politics to rise. I'm not actually particularly optimistic that we have any role to play in this whatsoever right now at this state. And I don't think that the working class broadly, as a class for itself, has any real role. Even if you saw protests, direct action on the scale of George Floyd again, I'm not sure that that's necessarily what's scary to them or what they fear, because I think they were very adept at using that last time and with the George Floyd uprising to their for their own interest. What I think instead is that this is happening in the realm of bourgeois politics and coalitions and alignments and realignments. And I think if you look back at the history of the last 15, 20 years or so, or let's go farther back. Let's go all the way back to NAFTA. Even as like the policies and even as the realities of the economy and politics have led to like a massive decline over the past 30, 35 years of like industrial employment in the United States, good jobs, you know, as the politicians call them, good union jobs, as we on the left call them. The ruling class still has been very, very, very cognizant of like, or at least aware of or interested in the legitimacy of their project vis-a-vis like the old traditional working class. I think what scared the crap out of the older ruling class, let's just call it the Democratic Party ruling class, is that they made a huge put, like $1 trillion put, towards reintegrating large swaths of what's left of the traditional working class in the automotive industry, towards like reintegrating them back into a coalition in a sustainable way. And what I think scares them about Trumpism is that large swaths of that demographic, which they're very interested in maintaining, the not just as like Democrats, but the ruling class is interested in the legitimacy of their own system vis-a-vis these people, you know, because they're scared of them and their power. Them joining broadly like middle class forces, small business forces, the MAGA coalition, I think scares them because it throws their entire claim, like all of their political claims, up in the air, which is that there is a system in place. You can call it like quasi social democracy. You can call it I don't know, the democratic administrative state, the progressive administrative state, includes the Federal Reserve. It includes a lot of Republicans too, but basically there's a steady hand on the tiller. There's a steady hand on the wheel. We've managed to craft an expert state, a state full of expertise, not just when it comes to science and technology, but also when it comes to trade policy, when it comes to the Federal Reserve and interest rates. We've created an entire apparatus, like a wet blanket to throw over society and the economy, that like we can tamp things down when they get scary. We can use policy to ensure that there's full employment. We can make sure that the poor among the working class are fed, you know, that they have SNAP benefits or that they have welfare, that they have Section 8. We'll take care of the dregs of society, you know. This entire apparatus that's been created over the last 100 years or so is one that, like, I don't think that they're just ideologically attached to. I think that this is like a source of the old ruling class's power, and it's also a source of their legitimacy as well. And I think that MAGA, in its own way, represents a an attack on that. And I think that's what we're seeing with Elon Musk and Doge right now, is like a full frontal attack on the way that a certain, not just ruling class, but also middle class, reproduces itself through the state. And I think the attacks upon the administration state are, on the administrative state, are Trump and Musk's retribution campaign that they spoke about. They're somehow smart enough in their insanity and their idiocy to understand that, like, USAID, for example, does reproduce an American style, like, liberal middle class wherever it goes, including in Ukraine, including in Georgia, including in France and Germany and the UK. And then if they can get to the heart of what reproduces that social relation, that reproduces that relationship between middle class, educated middle classes and their particular states and the broader empire, that they can actually attempt to overthrow this old regime being the 20th century.
when you describe it in that way, the array of forces, institutional, ideological, whatever, that are arrayed behind that self-understanding of this is that we have spent a lot of time building this, you know, powerful state structure, state, and not just narrowly the state, but involving universities, involving
NGOs,
the entire apparatus. Okay, that how would you articulate the kind of the social composition of the MAGA forces and beyond that are arrayed against it? In other words, it's one thing for the MAGA folks to have pulled the rabbit out of the hat and to win the election by admittedly very narrow margins, all right? But what are the social political forces that are arrayed behind the MAGA folks so that it's not just, you know, Trump and Musk and J.D. Vance?
Right. It's not just ideas and like a hodgepodge of random capitalists, like vulture capitalists like Trump or tech capitalists like Musk or whatever. That's, I think, the million-dollar question. And I think that that's why it's hard to be optimistic at this time, because the forces behind MAGA are not what we would recognize as like progressive forces. In fact, quite the opposite, like very regressive. And I think maybe it's going to take some time for like the results of this election to filter down to all of us, for the poll watchers and sociologists to do their work so we can figure out sociologically what the actual composition is. But I think we can be reasonably certain, and I can be reasonably certain because I work with a lot of MAGA people. You know, building trades is like ground zero, I think, for the attempt to try to bring industrial workers on board with like a new reindustrialization, a new border regime, a new attempt to like integrate the working class into a Reagan-esque, like Reagan 2.0 type project. Ground zero is Teamsters and building trades, right? So I've seen it myself. I think that like broadly, what does MAGA represent? It represents like medium to small size, like regional capitalists. And what people might call PMC groups, like, you know, a lot of this gets real weird sociologically because you're talking in like bourgeois class terms, not Marxist class terms, but like what we might call a PMC, but one's more attached to like tech and finance, like fintech, than maybe attached to like universities and hospitals and things of that sort. And then just like a hodgepodge of like, it seems like minority working class men, black and Latino. A lot, there's been a huge shift towards Trump. And then some of the commanding heights of like vulture capitalist industry, like it seems like hedge funds, some private equity, many of the big players in Silicon Valley who kind of want to bring home the advantages that they've created for themselves and kind of pull the ladder up behind them as they kind of more visibly show their class rule. I think this is kind of what the MAGA coalition is right now. And it's not a very fruitful one, I think, for like the political economy of this moment. But what I think they're banking on is that using DOGE, using deregulation, using like juicing the assets markets and juicing real estate markets, whatever it is, that they can really pull off like a coup d'etat and manage to do with the United States Empire what the British could not do with their own, which is reverse a process of financialization and free trade, which has gone on for 50 years, reverse that, pull a rabbit out of a hat again, and using some combination of tariffs and deregulation, make America great again by reindustrializing it, which would be, I don't think in the history of capitalism, something that's ever been done before. But also maybe something that hasn't been tried before. We should take the attempt seriously, as much as I doubt that it's possible to do that. You know, I'm not sure that Trump and even like the majestic powers of the U.S. state, such as they are, I'm not sure it's possible to reverse that decline. Maybe it is. I don't know.
I read a few things recently about what's sometimes referred as the PayPal mafia. Part of it has to do with this weird South African connection.
What is that? I never heard that. Did they had connections going back to the old country?
Musk is, his family is from South Africa.
Right.
He grew up in South Africa.
Mark Andreessen is another one of those kind of finance tech folks, is also has a South African connection. And there are still more. that, I mean, actually, Steve Bannon, when he goes off, okay, he say, his attitude is, go, all of you, go back to South Africa.
Because he's the pop, he's the actual, he actually takes the populism of MAGA seriously, right?
And I mean, he actually kind of accuses Musk of being an apartheid fighter, you know, fighter for apartheid and stuff like that. And it's not so, you know, surprising that recently Trump really clamped down on South Africa in response to requests from some of the remaining Afrikaner centers of rural power, okay, and that Musk apparently played a part. But in any case, I wanted to turn to the question of that the finance people, or not the finance, the, rather the tech people in Silicon Valley, but not only physically there, basically are people are industries that have no workers.
Right.
So all of the production work of all of that technology is done elsewhere. I mean, there's not an iPhone made in America. The iPhones are designed in America.
Yeah, the IP exists in America.
And the technology, the software technology is probably housed here. Those folks, to the extent that they represent a not insignificant center of power, or, you know, inside the larger political economic spectrum, they're not interested in reindustrialization.
Right.
They actually are perfectly, more than perfectly content to kind of live without workers. And I think that part of Musk's Doge strategy is to use the federal government as a proving ground for that, that you can, that virtually all of these, or not all, but an enormous number of these workers can be replaced by technology, by software, whether it's the AI variant or traditional, you know, kind of data processing, I don't know. And so I think that the, I guess I would not, someone, when I circulated something about Bannon going off on Musk and Thiel and whatever, okay, wrote, a friend wrote to me saying that just keep in mind our enemy, the enemy of our enemy is not our friend. And I said, I understand that full well, okay, but the enemy of the enemies are enemies to each other. That's of some consequence.
Yeah.
That I think that some of these squabbles amongst the kind of the thieves are in fact real fights.
Yes.
And that I think that there are people who would love to see Musk trashed, you know, kind of in one way or another. And then, of course, he would love to see some other people trashed. Well, who's going to win that one? I don't know.
I think the sense is that that Musk's time is numbered, right? Because the liberal media keeps trying to play this game where they're trying to get Trump to, like, be jealous, I guess, of Elon Musk's power as he prosecutes Doge, you know? They're attempting through like Saturday Night Live to show Musk as like the true president, you know, and maybe Donald Trump is subservient to him. And I think a very like kind of backhanded and maybe childish way of trying to get Trump to live up to their vision of him, which is a deeply unserious person who's only interested in ego or whatever. I think honestly, as much as I hate to say it, you know, the last 5 years or so, and I think the evolution of Trump from like citizen to politician, with all his grievances and all his foibles, has shown that he's more than that. He's not just a basket of emotions. He's not just instincts. He's not just a bully. That there's actually some there, right? But I do think that right now the PayPal mafia, or Musk as representing this sort of fraction of the U.S. economy, a very powerful one. You know, the Magnificent Seven is what they used to call the FANGs, right? Which is all the tech stocks. Those are the ones where all the growth of the U.S., quote unquote, growth of the U.S. economy has come from through the Biden years. And so it's not surprising that Musk and company, Silicon Valley, if you want to call them that, or tech pros, are like using this opportunity to make their big put, you know, to glom on to MAGA and attempt to turn it in their direction. Because as I said before, they went from like a rising fraction of the capitalist class to now like a potential incumbency. And I think they want to use MAGA and this second Trump administration as a way to sort of solidify their political and market power, you know?
The tech industry is, oddly enough, starved for money, because so many of the things, so many of their projects are just absolutely exhausting money that they just gobble up. If they have to build a data center,
oh, yeah,
powerful enough to kind of handle X or Y, AI this or AI that. I mean, they say things like that this single power plant, okay, produces enough power to kind of for the entire city of Salt Lake City, you know, just.
Or one data center.
One data center. Right. And I think that those are, they kind of are starved for money. And what they've been given under the Biden years, okay, is lots of money.
Yeah,
there's been money flowing to them. And they've become even, I think there's a lot of stuff about Musk, how dependent Musk's enterprises are on a variety of governmental subsidies or reimbursements, that it's not quite, you know, General Motors probably always depended on a certain amount of federal dollars to build tanks and trucks. So like,
right.
But they also built millions of cars, right?
Right.
Those cars to regular people.
Yeah.
That's where I think that there's some fragility in the enterprise.
If you listen to like not the Financial Times side of the financial press, but like the Wall Street Journal side of the financial press, they will talk about Bidenism, the CHIPS Act, the IRA, whatever it is, all the direct federal subsidies that have gone into green energy or data centers or whatever it is, crowding out, you know, private investment. So I think that sense that you get that, you know, it's a lack of capital, you know, that's driving a lot of the politics of Musk and company. I think that's right. I think that they feel as though the capital markets are skewed way towards bonds. They're skewed way towards like, you know, a direct federal subsidy of industry, when instead what the Silicon Valley folks, the Musks of the world would want would be like, Silicon Valley Bank to come back or something. They want like a new reservoir of capital. Certainly as like it seems like China and Russia and others, large parts of the global south have bailed on the U.S. capital markets, whereas maybe Europe hasn't, but Europe becomes less and less relevant, I think, as the years go on. I think you're starting to see Europe's irrelevance become really, 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 really clear. So you're, before we go too much further, you're working on a project regarding our old friend Lauren Goldner's legacy. Did you want to talk a little bit about that?
Thank you. Lauren died just less than a year ago. And I've been spending a lot of time trying to preserve various aspects of the work that he did, which, you know, kind of, it's complicated and it's time consuming. But so there's several things I'm working on are the following. One of which is Lauren left behind, or not so surprisingly, a set of papers.
His Grundrisse.
That's the name of his Grundrisse, which are surprisingly better organized than people thought, but they still need to be cataloged. They still need to be sorted out. What is here? What's not here? And what should we do with it? And we have now been able to find a young woman and a man out in the Bay Area, in Los Angeles, rather, where the papers are physically located now, to actually go through all of the boxes and do a kind of a first sort of cataloging. It is, you know, this box contains correspondence between Lauren and the following 20, 30 odd people, and the topics covered are so and so, so forth. That is intended to, and then there's a small group of people who have agreed to contribute money to absorb the cost of that cataloging work, which is now underway. Took a while to sort it out, but it's now underway. And the idea is eventually that having produced a useful catalog, to try then to interest some institutional place, probably a university library, it doesn't necessarily have to be that,
right,
to agree to take the papers, to preserve them in a collection, and to make them available.
The Tamiment Library, or maybe something related to the University of California. But they need to know, you need to know what you're offering them first. You're right.
And so, and that work is underway. It's probably going to take another few months for it to be completed. And I think that it's going, so far, as I understand it, pretty well. The young woman involved, okay, has just finished a degree in archival studies, so she has the professional training that she needs, and she has her own interest in this. This is not something that she's just doing it as a job. It is a job, but it's more than a job. So that's one thing. The second thing is that in 2017, a couple of Italian comrades, Emiliano and Rafe, okay, arranged to conduct four extensive interviews with Lauren. They called them conversations about different aspects of his life, some of them deeply personal and autobiographical, going back to his childhood and young adulthood as a student activist at Berkeley and beyond, and then his progression over time through a variety of different political scenes and political kind of understandings. So there's an extensive analysis of his take on 1968. Uh-huh. And related phenomena. Then there's another thing on his take on various aspects of political economy, most famously his analysis of fictitious capital and all sorts. Then there's also a series of questions and answers rather about Asia, because Lauren spent some time in Korea and he was studying Chinese and he became reasonably knowledgeable about what was going on. He was, at a certain point, he was convinced that kind of when he sensed that the East, I sure hope that the East is red. It doesn't look so red anywhere else.
Yeah.
And so they published a book in Italian of those conversations with Lauren's help. And Steve Wright, who I mentioned previously, was the person who translated Lauren's English into Italian. I think I forget exactly the sequence. It was done by email. But so they eventually they published a book in Italian. Probably in 2018, 2019, when soon after Lauren's death, they contacted us and inquired about whether we'd be interested at all in publishing an English language version. All right. So we agreed. When I say we, this is me and Dave Ranney at the moment. Okay. And they've been working on editing their versions, which is mostly done, and writing a new introduction. I've been writing an introduction for the English language publication, which is almost done. And so we're assembling that text, and we're now going to try soon to turn to finding a publisher who might querling in to publish it. I think it's going to be really valuable because it sheds light on aspects of Lauren's life and personality that he most of the time didn't talk about. You know,
yeah,
it was like growing up in this kind of red diaperish kind of scene in Berkeley.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of very funny episodes of him, you know, kind of finding and losing girlfriend and things of that sort. But then along with that, you know, kind of insights into the development of Lauren's political thought over time, especially influenced by his, what eventually became worldwide travels. Political, personal friends all over the place.
Yeah.
And that his worldview was
he was a true internationalist, proletarian internationalist.
Same time, we're also preparing a next issue of Insurgent Notes, which is going to be primarily a collection of writings in response to Lauren's writings. People wrote about the things I read, Remaking of the American Work Class, and it made an enormous difference to me. Let me tell you why. Mm-hmm. So, along with probably a few what might be considered not quite secret, but much less well-known kind of writings that Lauren himself did that are almost all of which are available on his webpage, which is Break Their Haughty Power. And that we now also have, for the first time, a reasonably thorough list of all of Lauren's writings so that we can make sure that people have a sense of, if I want to read Lauren, this is what's there, stuff like that. And the so that there's three out of four. And there's, I think, one more that we're working on.
In the meantime, while you think of that fourth thing, I mean, this is part of the thing that's inspired me, right, is that Lauren's no longer with us, but it sounds like you're working on his mega, you know, compiling all of his various documents and thoughts together, which I think is an extremely valuable project. Before I forget, there's a new version and from AK Press of The Housing Monster by Prol.info, which yours truly wrote the forward to. So if people want to go, and I suppose we can put this in the show notes, but we are going to have Prol.info on the Antithought at some point. If you go to the AK Press website, you can order.
Okay.
Great. Housing Monster, and I'm in there. The first thing I've ever written that's been actually published in a real thing. So that's really exciting. But more broadly, and I think as relating to this project, is that, John, I'm glad for the next, you know, however amount of time that you and I are going to sit down occasionally across from one another, and we'll do bonus episodes, and you can tell me stories of the past. We can talk like we've been talking today about current events and political economy and where we think things are going. And I think it's very valuable because, you know, it's not just Lauren who had political thought. You know, you've been involved in a lot over the years. And I think all of us would benefit from your experience and your stories and your analysis of things. So, again, if you're not a patron, sign up now. John and I.
Well, one of the people it reminds me of, Sean, and if you remember this, is soon after Lauren died, you and Andy invited some of his younger friends onto an Antifada broadcast to talk about their recollections of Lauren and the extent to which he had influenced them. And it was very moving. I knew almost all of the people, but especially for them to talk about how thoughtful and considerate Lauren was about their development and their kind of an answering any question that they had. And one of the things that caught me by surprise, okay, as I was listening, is that at one point Jared Shanahan spoke up and he said, I just want to make sure that all of you out there know, in light of the fact that Lauren is no longer with us and Noel is no longer with us, okay, bring John Bob, Yvonne, or Chicken Sue. That caught me by surprise.
Yeah, well, you know, you are an inheritor of a tradition, right? We go back to the new left, right? But you and Lauren were like a part of that, but also not, because I feel like your left communist influences, the fact that you, Heinrich Grossman, you found him early. I remember you and me sitting 15 years ago. We grabbed a beer. I think it was in Carroll Gardens. And you told me kind of your whole deal and how much Heinrich Grossman meant to all of you back in the 70s when you discovered him, and how that kind of that Marxist political economy kind of guided your politics from there on out. But, you know, you are part of a school and you're part of the new left, but also not a part of it, too. Always, it seems like people like you and Lauren and Noel have had a sort of critical appraisal of the leftism that was happening around you, which I think is really valuable, because I think this is a really good moment right now for there to be a sort of self-conscious, self-confident, critical analysis of the left from within the left, because it is such a mess right now, you know?
One of the things that's in that collection of interviews that I mentioned, conversations that Lauren talks about, and he talks about it very movingly and even emotionally, and that was also very unusual for Lauren, is how often he found himself feeling isolated. And I think the Italian comrades who kind of in their introduction make the point that Lauren's isolation was not especially a psychological isolation. It was an isolation from him holding on to a set of political principles and political understandings that were most of the time very far away from what might be considered the left mainstream or official Marxism and stuff like that. And that so often he appears to be kind of fighting against the wind. And that's not the easiest thing in the world to do.
No.
For any of us.
Yeah.
But I'm not especially in favor of us feeling isolated. It would be better by far for us to feel connected. But I guess this goes to something else you've hinted at, is that we have, for the most part, done a pretty terrible job of kind of making converts. I'm not so much interested in, you know, kind of standing on the corner, but rather that if you wanted to count the number of people who imagine themselves to be on the far left, the numbers are only marginally greater today than they might have been 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Sure.
To some extent, we only have ourselves to blame for that. Now, exactly what the remedy would have been, that I don't know. It's not because people didn't try. I want to be careful about that.
Yeah.
I perhaps said this the other time when we met, is that I am continued to be, I'm sure we did, we spoke about it as well, surprised by how many people who consider themselves on the left, and I take them at their word that that's an accurate description, still for whom their political horizon is all but completely defined by the Democratic Party.
Yeah, we did speak about that. I think that's sort of an enduring legacy of the failures of 68, right? The failures to carve out a different path. And I wouldn't say the failures of you and Lauren and Noel and people of that sort, but maybe like the reasons why Lauren felt that isolation is that this grand apparatus of recuperation and sort of reproduction of capitalist social relations and whatever kind of left, became the left and left the left behind in a certain way, right? Like what you and Lauren and others represented was an alternative that was the only possible alternative I feel like the left could have gone in order to retain some legitimacy and gain converts or whatever. But instead, you know, of course, the path of least resistance was where the money and the power was and the jobs were, because certainly one thing that's ending now, and maybe this will be the end of the main episode and we'll move towards the bonus. One of the senses that you get with this DOGE attack on the civil service and the federal government and the NGOs is that, like, this is a God that's failed, you know, that this quasi-social Democratic Party, also Republican Party, Uniparty, let's call it, apparatus that sustained itself since 1968 and well before that, both ideologically and politically, through the U.S. state, is exhausted. Exhausted by its own logic, on its own merits. And that this apparatus is what the left has meant through all of my lifetime and much of yours too. So it's important for us, I think, to excavate what other potentials there might have been coming out of this great revolutionary moment of the 1960s, or maybe quasi-revolutionary. We could talk about that. Have such a hard time imagining a horizon beyond Obama or Obamaism, like a perfected sort of capitalist welfare state. Maybe the more radical among them imagine like 1917 creating like a new Meidner plan or something like that. Like,
you know, as you're saying that, one thing that I'm reminded of is that some many years ago, obviously, because David Graeber is long gone,
yeah.
He wrote an essay where he tried to understand what had happened to the movement of the 60s. And he talked, one of the things he emphasized was the way in which that it had become so thoroughly academic. And he talked about the kind of that the people who were kind of entering into the academy after having been, however briefly, part of the radical upsurge of the 60s. And seriously, not misjudging anyone's motivations, that they were offered a bargain, okay? And the bargain was this: you would be able to get more or less secure employment, okay? And in the case of those who have tenure, more or less definite.
Yeah, it makes six figures even. Hey, folks. Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall. Bye.